Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real, positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Chad Nelson, the CEO of Surfrider.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Chad. I'm super excited to dive into a conversation with you. No pun intended. Tell our listeners a bit about yourself. How did you first become passionate about surfing and the coastal community?
Yeah, I pretty much grew up and have spent my whole life at the beach and at the ocean. When I was a really little kid, my family moved to a small island in Micronesia called Saipan, and I spent some formative years there. And my dad was an ocean science educator. So I've been kind of in and amongst and on the ocean ever since I could remember. So it seemed like a natural extension of the place where I grew up.
That's incredible. What an amazing childhood you must have had. And I can just imagine how deep-rooted that connection may be because it was so instilled from childhood. Bringing that into your adult life, what was the driver behind the creation of Surfrider, and how do you operate now?
Yeah, so I didn't found the Surfrider Foundation, but I've been involved with the organization for 26 of our 40 years, so for a long time. And Surfrider was founded in Southern California in 1984, so we just celebrated our 40th anniversary. And the primary reason was that, you know, surfers are this regular ocean-going, you know, group of people who are intimately connected with our coasts and our oceans, but they weren't being considered in coastal management decisions. So decisions were being made that either eliminated surf spots, polluted the ocean, or reduced beach access to the oceans. Back in those days, you know, surfers were sort of disparaged as a bunch of burned out hippies and weren't being considered. So they founded the organization to sort of create a voice for the surfing community. And in that 40 years, it's really evolved far beyond that to be just sort of a voice for anyone who cares about the ocean.
So it started off almost as a community project within the surfing community and expanded out to something that connects both scientists, grassroots movements, local groups, which I'm super excited to dive into today. How would you describe for our listeners how climate change is impacting our oceans and the coastal environments? And what is Surfrider doing to address these effects?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, historically, the oceans haven't been included in the climate change conversation as much as they should be, given that they're absolutely at the center of it. 90% of the excess heat that we've produced that's trapped in our atmosphere has been absorbed by the oceans. So they've been buffering the heat. We'd be in a much better, worse place if it wasn't for the oceans. And 30% of the carbon has been absorbed by the oceans. But, you know, that's having effects. So all that heat being absorbed is warming the ocean, which is impacting coral reefs. It's expanding the ocean through thermal expansion, which is increasing sea level rise. And then, of course, the polar ice caps are melting, creating sea level rise. And so the effect of all those things is that we're seeing coastal erosion at our beaches. We're seeing stronger and faster accelerating hurricanes. We're watching marine life migrate to areas that are different than they've been because of a warmed ocean. And, you know, it's threatening coral reefs. So it's having a profound impact on the ocean. You know, and as a surfer, erosion, storms, loss of coral reefs, these are all things that are going to impact coastal recreation and surfing.
These are a lot of compound effects internationally that are affecting communities all around the world. What is Surfrider doing to address these issues locally, on the beaches, on the seafront?
Yeah, that's a great question. We sort of have a three-pronged approach to, you know, climate change is such a big issue that it's easy to be overwhelmed. And so we spent some time really saying, hey, what can our organization do? Where can we contribute? Because we can't solve the whole problem ourselves. No one can. So we've really focused on sort of three things. One is restoring coastal habitats. So mangroves, wetlands, dunes, seagrasses, kelp forests, these ecosystems absorb a ton of carbon. They call it blue carbon. And they also buffer our coastlines from storms. We've lost a lot of those coastal habitats. So by restoring them, we can create a more resilient coast, absorb more carbon, and restore incredible sort of ecosystems. We're also working with communities. So that could look like a dune planting project in your local community or a wetland restoration project. We're also working with communities to adapt to sea level rise and move back from the coasts. The amount of warming we've put into the global system is going to result in sea level rise for thousands of years. No matter what we do, if we cease pumping carbon into the atmosphere tomorrow, we would still see that sea level rise. And so we need to move back from our coastlines and figure out how to adapt our coastal communities. And so we're working on projects to show how that can happen. Not easy to do. And then third, we're really working on policy issues to continue to ensure that we address carbon pollution and figure out how to minimize the amount of greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere. So that could look like a local resolution to use green sources of energy in your community, all the way up to the federal or global level.
Amazing. This three-pronged effect, you've kind of got your hands in all these different plots, kind of looking at the data and saying, okay, we know that we have to target the coast restoratively. We know that we have to change the policy about how we're looking at these coasts as well. I kind of want to know, with all these different pots, what is the typical day like for the Surfrider team? Is there a typical day?
Yeah, I'm not sure there is a typical day. And, you know, we unfortunately now have a new president who's anti-climate change and anti-environment. So in the last 3 weeks, our day has looked at or has been about what critical protections, agencies or laws are being undone or attempted to be undone. And how can we effectively fight against those? So the U.S. just left the Paris Accord. Some of our critical agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and our National Ocean Agency are being threatened, and some of our important efforts to minimize climate change. So right now it looks like playing defense.
We just had Rachel Graham from Mar Alliance on a few weeks ago, and I've been in contact with her since she's been on the show, and it's been a lot of trouble, and she's been really fighting this cause hard.
Normally what it looks like, we have 200 chapters and clubs across the U.S. and seven mm-hmm. international affiliates, and so an average day usually looks like, where are the campaigns on the ground having most impact? You know, how can our science, policy, and legal team support those campaigns, and how can we scale local campaigns into larger state, federal, international campaigns? So that could look like, hey, we've got an effort to redesign the coast in Ventura, California, at a place called Surfers Point, this coastal adaptation project. What lessons can we learn from that project, and how can we use that to apply those lessons to other parts of the coastline?
Well, that seeps in perfectly to my next question. I was just going to ask you about these grassroots strategies, and obviously this one that you've just mentioned is it Ventura, California?
Correct, yeah.
Yes. So with these grassroots movements protecting these local and coastal ecosystems, can you explain what these approaches are, how effective they've been, and how you're using them as a baseline to then apply out to your other projects, and how you then use them towards policy?
Yeah, you know, the sort of theory of change or philosophy of Surfriders, we're this grassroots organization. So we believe that, you know, at the end of the day, every action takes place at the local level. You know, if we have a federal pollution law, at the end of the day, it's what's happening down at the coasts that's going to affect sort of, you know, whether that pollution enters the water or not. And so we try to work from the ground up. So, you know, in Ventura, for example, we've been working for years to move a eroding bike path and a walkway that's been falling into the ocean back from the coast and restore the dunes and the natural beach habitat. And it's a great case study for coastal adaptation, what we need to do in the face of sea level rise. So once we have a local solution like that, we can use that as an example to try to scale that. So we're both doing that in other communities. So we have another project at a state park called San Onofre State Park right now, and another project up in Oregon. And so we try to like replicate the learnings at the local level and then scale it up to the state and the federal level. So, you know, California, for example, a piece of good news that came out of our last election, passed something called Proposition 4 to put $10 billion into climate change. And a big chunk of that's for coastal resilience. So we're trying to take the local Surfers Point project, create momentum to apply that kind of solution at the state level, and then ultimately scale that up to the federal level. So a lot of organizations sort of work it from the top down, and we're working from the bottom.
All hoping to meet in the middle.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
With the initial foundation of the creation of Surfrider, you mentioned that a lot of it had to do with these surfing communities really being aware of the changes in their water quality, water pollution, all these kind of things. So I'm aware that Surfrider conducts research on coastal water quality and plastic pollution, ecosystem health. Can you share some of the insightful findings that you've received from these data logs and how this has influenced your strategies and how you've looked to make more impact through the organization?
Yeah, you know, surfers, beachgoers, these people are very avid participants on the coastline. So a lot of people are down at the beach every single day or many days a week, and they're observing changes on the coastline just by virtue of being there. So they're sort of like natural historians of the coast. And so we wanted to sort of take advantage of these surfer scientists or these local, their knowledge. And so, you know, through our beach cleanup program, we do thousands of beach cleanups a year. We collect data on what we find at the beach, and we also do thousands of water tests. So if we're down there, we have folks collect water samples and analyze.
Are these the surfers themselves going out with little vials, checking out the water?
Yeah, it's the surfers and also just beachgoers. It's students. It's anyone sort of who cares about the ocean. And so those things do a couple of different things. One, we're sort of taking that local knowledge and formalizing it. And we're also kind of giving their observations scientific credibility. So if you look at beachcleanups.surfrider.com, there's hundreds of thousands of plastic items we found on the beach or trash that we found on the beach categorized. So now we know what the top 10 most polluted items are. And so if you go to your city council meeting or a legislature or like, you know, our Congress, and you talk about the plastic you're seeing at the beach, you're now an expert because you have data that you help create. So it gives you credibility. And we can also say, you know, we're finding single-use bags, styrofoam, single-use bottles, and say that with authority because we know what they are. Or this river is polluting this coastal area and this surf spot 25% of the time, and we know what the source is because we've been collecting the data. And so what we're really trying to do is sort of empower locals with, you know, citizen and community science to help them become more powerful advocates.
That's incredible. There's real community ownership over the work and the data that you're getting here. With that being said, we're going to take our first break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Chad Nelson, the CEO of Surfrider. We just picked up on the amazing community empowerment and programs that Surfrider are running in terms of their checks on water quality and plastic pollution that are happening along our coasts, and really using that to advocate for policy changes. Chad, can you share a story of where Surfrider's work has made a tangible difference in the lives of the coastal community, the surfing communities, really enhancing their resilience or spirit or quality of life?
Yeah, I can give you a good example that happened, sort of one of our sort of bigger wins in the last decade. There's a very famous surf spot and a beautiful state park that's full of sort of, it's a wetland and a river mouth called Trestles. It's in San Onofre State Park. This is a place where they hold, global world surfing championships. It's really a gem of a surf spot and of just a beach in general. And about 15 years ago, the state of California planned to put a 5-lane toll road, private highway, and gut this watershed, destroy a campground, and have it sort of collide right at the beach with this beautiful surf spot. And it would have had profound impact on quality of the surf, the water quality, the nature experience of this place. It's the fifth most visited state park in California. And it was already on the map. The governor of California at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator, was supportive of it. We were told that we absolutely couldn't stop it. It was an unstoppable project. And it was in our backyard. And the surfing community, you know, decided, well, we're going to fight this no matter what. And thousands and thousands of people rallied at the various hearings over the course of years. And set records for attendance at every public hearing. You know, I called it the Woodstock of surfing conservation because it became so many people came, it became celebratory. There were bands and there were costumes. And ultimately,
I just wanted to pick up. Sorry, yeah. I don't mean to quick. I just wanted to quickly jump
ahead,
in there.
Go ahead.
I loved how you described that. I think oftentimes that we see a lot of climate protests or environmental protests on television. They're kind of projected it by the media in such a negative, derogatory way. And what you just mentioned there was such true community collectiveness of joy and connectivity through movement, sound, bringing people together in a positive way that wasn't destructive, that was showing people's advocacy and love for their planet, their area, their homes, and the work that they wanted to stop taking place so that they could have a restorative effect. And sorry, I just wanted to jump on that. And I think our listeners,
I appreciate that because I do think that's important. You know, these were thousands of people who love this place, who came together to sort of celebrate the community that cares. And, you know, it was a public hearing. So we all had our 3 minutes of testimony and it was entirely peaceful. And it was hugely positive. And we also won. And last week was surfing down at this beautiful state park, looking at the birds in the coastal wetlands. It's a spectacular place. And every time I go there, I'm reminded that, you know, this is and it could have been lost, right? This incredible place, because once it's very hard to bring something back once you destroy it. You know, it's much better to, it's an ounce of prevention. It's much better to protect these places. And importantly, it also showed that, you know, and I think this is important, particularly in the times we're in right now, is that this was people power. This was local people. You know, we were told we couldn't do it. The politics and the power were in opposition to us. But the sheer number of individuals who turned up and said, this is important to me, was what ultimately made the difference. And so it's a good reminder that, you know, in often cases, we may not have the power and we may not have the money, but we have the people. And as 100%. Long as we have democratic societies, that is going to be to our advantage. And more people care about these places. It's mostly about complacency and getting them off the couch and off their phones and out to these hearings, making their voices heard.
It's one thing that I have truly advocated for in my 10 years working in science communication with my background in biology. It's imperfect sustainability. It's this idea that we can make huge changes en masse. We don't have to do everything right. But for situations like you've just mentioned, knowing that, okay, I know that my presence and my energy, my movement in rallying people, being present, supporting a movement like that could make a difference. And it did make a difference. And this can happen all around the world because that is a great example of positive policy changes that have happened. But there are thousands of places across the world where negative changes are continually happening. You've already mentioned with the changes currently taking place with the new presidency and removal from Paris Accords and climate legislation. So, well, let's not jump into the negative. We're positive here, guys. We're positive.
No.
Come on, back into the gist of things. Yeah. I wanted to talk about technology. So that's a big surge of like where conservation is moving into with the integration of technology, the integration of AI. How do you see or hope that technology can make a difference in ocean and coastal conservation?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. I think, you know, on one hand, you know, all this technology is a little bit scary because we were just talking about the power of people, right? And, and this is stuff that may sort of try to minimize that. And so I worry a little bit, but we still don't. There's so much, you know, we know more about the moon than the ocean. We've explored less than 10% of the ocean. And our coastal zones, where we sort of do most of our work, are the most dynamic landscapes on the earth. And so they're ever changing. And so I do think there's a lot of opportunity to better understand change, better understand these systems that we're trying to protect that are quite mysterious. And so I do think there's a lot of opportunity sort of in monitoring and understanding change, you know, maybe breaking down some of the propaganda around climate change you know, oh, it's not changing, or it is, or how fast, or it's noise in the system. So I think there's some sort of truth that we can discover because we're collecting massive amounts of data around our ocean. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to sort of synthesize that and understand it more quickly, I think could play a really important role. And, you know, on the flip side, what AI is doing is it's putting the power into the hands of the people, right? So I think there's opportunities for all of us to become sort of better citizen scientists by having access to the information. So if the limitation is only your curiosity, people are incredibly curious. And so maybe it'll generate sort of more ocean advocates.
100%. I think it's honestly how we utilize it. Even when it comes to AI, and I was thinking about what you mentioned earlier in terms of the data sets of items collected by people on the coastal communities, and you've got that backlog on your website. As you were speaking, I was thinking, well, maybe AI could be used as a way to analyze this backlog and look at future trends of how this is changing and progressing as these policy changes we're all advocating for are taking place, seeing, okay, like, are these making tangible differences in the way consumers, us, are behaving and the way that we are polluting? Because I feel like we will continue to be a polluting species for at least the next 20 to 30 decades. But it's just, it's an unfortunate reality, but how we adapt and change that is the way that we need to look forward.
Yeah, another example that you made me think of is, you know, one of the things when we're collecting the items on the beach is, you know, we're curious about what brands are responsible for most of the pollution. So, for example, you know, if we were taking pictures, you could identify the brands on the plastic we're finding. And so we could shift from saying, hey, it's about foam or bottles to, hey, this is about Coca-Cola or Nestle or...
Yeah. Coca-Cola was the first name that came to my head when you said that.
The big plastic producers are. And so that would increase pressure on them to, you know, be part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem.
Looking at solutions and the discussion that we've had around grassroots movements, community movements, how do you think that those people out there that do love and admire our oceans and beaches, but honestly, they may feel unsure how to help. They don't know what's going on at the moment in terms of like how they can get involved. What are the ways the average person, do you think, could do research, find their involvement, find out about more organizations like Surfrider? What do you think the average person who has that passion can be doing?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question because I think a lot of people want to make a difference, but they feel sort of overwhelmed or don't know where to start, you know. And I think, you know, the longest journey starts with the first step. And so it's just a matter of taking those little bite-sized steps. And, you know, I think getting involved with local organizations is a great way to start. It could be Surfrider in the U.S. It could be Surfers Against Sewage in the U.K. or any local grassroots group. You know, because at the end of the day, you know, what we're trying to do is make, you know, community stewardship, activism, and advocacy accessible to the public. You know, we have experts who have done this for decades. And so if you get involved and you show up for a beach cleanup, for example, A, you'll pick up some trash that day on the beach. You'll feel better about that. You'll contribute to the data. And maybe you'll ask yourself, why am I seeing so many foam container takeout containers, you know, takeaway containers at the beach? Maybe the local fish and chip shop shouldn't be handing those out with every meal. What can I do about that? And then you can learn about advocacy and how to change a law at your local community, you know, and then you can learn how to do that at the state level and at the federal level. And so I think, you know, there's sort of a, you know, like anything, you start small. You know, you can't play an instrument on day one. You learn how to play a couple notes and you work your way. And it's the same with advocacy. And so, but by getting involved with a local organization that has that sort of pipeline and that expertise, I think certainly you can do it on your own, and many do, but finding those local community groups is often a great way to do it. And the other, I think, important part about that is then you don't have to do it alone. You know, back to the story about trestles, advocacy is a lot more enjoyable when you're doing it with your friends.
That was beautifully said. I just want to jump back into what you mentioned with regard to how people can get involved. And I really like the point that you mentioned that I kind of would like to dub like almost like actionable insights with the reference to the takeaway containers, for example, from a local fish and chip shop, seeing the reality, the physicality in front of you, which could then motivate and strive you to equate that in terms of change. You'd be like, well, I've just picked up 50 containers. I don't want to be seeing 50 containers on my beach. Let me go talk to that shop. And then actually seeing that progressive change that you're advocating for, that you're trying to make, real sense of ownership there. And I think this stems into awareness and education. Surf Rider, you've got all these community involvement programs, these grassroots movements. Where do you think you guys connect the education factor, and what sort of like outreach and education programs do you offer both to people that do want to get involved, but even those that are really young and really just starting to learn about the ocean?
Yeah, you know, I am 54 years old. I'll give that away. You know, I have
54 20, years young.
thanks. You know, and I have 20-year-old twin boys, and I think every generation gets a little smarter and more aware of these issues. You know, I think when I was a little kid, they were trying to get us not to throw trash out the window of the car. Don't litter. You know, my generation was the recycled generation. And it turns out that was a little bit of a myth. You know, we recycle less than 10%. And I think this next generation is sort of like the reuse generation. So everyone's got a water bottle on their backpacks. And so I do think that there's a trend in the right direction generally, you know, and Surf Rider uses surfing and the ocean as inspiration. You know, we have 160 high school and college clubs in the U.S.
Amazing.
Yeah. So the youth is getting involved. And I mean, it's they're such a smart and motivated and active generation. I think they're like fundamentally, you know, making things happen faster than certainly we did in my generation. And so I think using sort of the joy and the passion of the ocean and ocean recreation, whether it's surfing, sailing, or swimming, and getting kids involved in youth and showing them that they can make a difference in their lives at that age as well is what certainly, this may preempt one of your later questions, but gives me hope.
I love that. You just mentioned that you have, what was it, 160. Could you talk us a bit through about how that came about and what you kind of look to do with these connections with these high schools?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we didn't do much other than offer the opportunity and sort of build a curriculum and a strategy around these clubs. There's overwhelming interest. It's the fastest growing part of our network. Part of it
are
is,
these organizations throughout, for example, the USA, or are they subjugated to particular states?
Yeah,
or
they're all over the place. So any, you know, almost every in the US, somewhere, every high school and every university has a club program generally. So it could be surfing, knitting, policy, debate, chess, whatever it is. And so we just sort of allowed the, you know, we built a club template and put it out into the world. And these kids just latched onto it. So yeah, so we have clubs in California, the Pacific Northwest, in the middle of the country, in Florida, all over the place. And I think it speaks to this sort of younger generation's interest in tackling these issues. Because, you know, as you know, generations before us started this problem, and we're starting to feel the impacts pretty significantly now. But the future without action is pretty dire. So these kids are particularly motivated because they're thinking about the world they're going to grow up in 30 to 50 years, and they want to make some change, which is incredibly encouraging.
Do you think on the flip side of that, with the mention of you earlier talking about how there's been sort of slow generational changes with the hyper awareness of sort of our impact now that we're having on the planet, do you think that's leading more driving forces in the youth, in the generations that are coming up now?
I absolutely do. I mean, I think sort of unfortunately, we tend to be a somewhat reactive species, you know, so we respond to flooding and after the flood damages communities, we sort of strengthen them. You know, after the hurricane rips off the roofs, we improve the standards for roofs. And here in California, you know, after the earthquake happens, we retrofit the buildings to survive earthquakes. And so we always seem to respond to the disaster after the disaster, even though we know better leading up to it. And so I think that's somewhat likely with climate change. And we're certainly feeling the impacts now. I think, you know, dreadful wildfires, stronger hurricanes and storms ravaging our coastlines, increased flooding. I mean, there's no community on Earth anymore that's safe from the impacts of climate change. And so we're feeling the impacts. And I think, you know, they say something 70 or 80% of people are now sort of feeling the impacts of climate change and are aware of them. So this is no longer some hypothetical future problem we're going to face. Mm. It's something we're in. And so to me, that the only upside to that is that it's going to drive action. And I think that's particularly true for the youth, because they're, you know, I might have 30 or 40 years left on the planet, but if you have 80 years on the planet, you're going to definitely be thinking about what that looks like more than maybe people who are in their 70s.
That is very true and perfect food for thought, just as we go on to our short break to hear from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Chad Nelson, the CEO of Surfrider, and we left off on this incredible thought around what the future holds for climate change and how we really think about the way that it's impacting us, the globe, and the future that we have in store. I really want to think about something that I talk about a lot on the station that, and I've brought up with quite a few guests so far, is this idea of responsible and ecotourism. Do you think this form of tourism can be a force for good in protecting our coasts and oceans? And if so, either way, how?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's interesting because you could make an argument that surfing was one of the first sort of ecotourism or tourism businesses. I mean, surfers explored a lot of part of the remote parts of Indonesia and all over the world. And the movie Endless Summer was one of the key influencers in sort of adventure travel generally. So surfers have certainly played an important role in sort of exploratory tourism. Now, whether or not that's been ecotourism is a really good question. And I think, you know, it can be, but it often isn't. And I think the key issues are, you know, are you leaving the community better than you found it? Or are you just taking from that community? You know, if you show up and you stay inside a walled resort or surf camp owned by foreigners and there isn't any contribution to the local community, I think it's, you know, a net negative. And certainly there are examples all over the world where surf tourism has brought on irresponsible development and sort of the dark side of tourism, whether that's, you know, drugs and other crime and other things. And so it certainly can have a negative impact. I think that's starting to shift in a positive way. And people are starting to realize that if I go to these places, I want to ensure that I'm contributing to the community that is there or was there before we started visiting. I think getting out into those communities and actually meeting and interacting with the people is positive on both sides. So I think there are ways to do it. And I think, you know, increasingly, if you're a surfer and you're looking to go travel the world surfing, you can find surf tourism that is much more responsible, both in terms of taking care of the place and importantly, taking care of the people or contributing to the betterment of the people in the community too. There's a fair amount of actually interesting, there's actually like academic research about surf tourism and ecotourism, which is great to see. There's a guy at San Diego State University named Jess Ponting, who's written on this topic for decades about the responsible surf tourism. So I think it's possible. I think it's up to the consumer to ensure that they're being conscientious about their choice and not just taking, but giving.
It's interesting because I've also been a participant in surf tourism. I originally surfed internationally prior to even surfing in the UK. I started learning to surf in Indonesia and then I surfed for the second time in Sri Lanka prior to surfing in the UK. But with my time in Sri Lanka, I was with a surf school that was built and run by locals, and that was incredible. You know, it was a slightly different experience than my time in Bali. When you mentioned this this research on surf and ecotourism, is this information available on Surfrider? Is this accessible by people that are your patrons?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have something called Beachopedia, which is like the Wikipedia for the coast. And I imagine we have information on there. It hasn't, to be honest with you, it hasn't been a huge focus of ours at Surfrider, although because we're really sort of about getting locals in their communities to get active and less focused on you know, certainly anyone who visits could come help us with the work. But I tend to point them to other folks like Jess and his Center for Surf Research when people ask me questions about that, because he's built a whole sort of whole academic institution around this topic. So he's a real specialist.
Incredible. I love that. And I will definitely have to look into his work, and hopefully I can get him on the show as well.
Yeah, he'd be a great guest. The work that he's doing. Fascinating guy.
When it comes to coastal pollution, climate change, a lot of the topics that we've been covering today, do you think there's misinformation regarding these issues and the way that it affects public perception? And how do you think we can combat and raise awareness about the challenges facing our oceans? One thing that I kind of want to link this back to is this idea of protesting, of trying to make these policy changes. For example, in UK media, particularly things surrounding Extinction Rebellion, for example, it's almost advertised on the news in a very negative way that I think really pushes people away from joining movements like this to actually make positive change. But you've mentioned here people coming together and actually actively making a positive change in a positive way for policy changes. But there is misinformation that still surrounds all of these issues. So unfortunately, I've leveled that question in a very convoluted way because I've given you a lot of information.
I can answer it. No.
Okay, amazing. I'm so glad that you stayed with me through that.
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that, and I can...
Yes, there is. There is two parts to that.
The misinformation is troubling, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, you know, whether it's plastic pollution and climate change are actually connected because they're both, you know, it's the petroleum, oil and gas, petroleum industry that's driving them. So plastic is really just, you know, solid oil and gas. And so, you know, and climate change...
Well, we're walking around. Half of us are walking around with plastic on us.
Yeah.
T-shirts.
I mean, I'm wearing it right now. And so, you know, those big industries, you know, there's these 70 industries that are companies that are causing most of the climate change. And they're the same ones producing the plastic. And so they're incentivized not to change. It's much like the smoking industry in the past that, you know, had a real incentive to sort of confuse and blur the health impact of cigarette smoking, you know, which was debated for decades while they made money. And we're in the same position here. So there's definitely a industry that's driving misinformation. So we're combating people who have great incentive, the biggest companies in the world, you know, and they're insidious. Things like this carbon footprint, you know, was created by British Petroleum to try to push the problem on the individual. And so they're smart and they're manipulative.
Creative marketing, greenwashing, just tip of the iceberg.
They have infinite amount of money to use all their tools at their disposal to influence us. And they're also, you know, influencing our politics. You know, we have a climate denying president in the United States because of that, you know, those industries. And I think, you know, with AI and social media, it's becoming harder and harder for people to perceive the truth from fake information. So we're up against a lot of big challenges when it comes to this. You know, not to sound like a broken record, but I also think, like, if you can get people on the ground who experience these issues in real life and they can communicate that to their peers and friends, I think that's how we break it down. So when you see something on your phone in social media, you know, you don't know the source necessarily, and it's hard to know the truth. But if you talk to your friend who was in a community that was ravaged by a storm, and he tells you about it, or she tells you about it, you're much more likely to believe them. So this idea of, like, firsthand experience and peer-to-peer communication, I think is, you know, it's hard to scale that as fast as the phone, but I think there are ways to try to combat the misinformation. And a very sort of prominent climate scientist, Catherine Cahill, in the United States, and she says, what's the most important thing you can do to inspire climate action? And she says, talk to your friends. And I think she's saying that because she knows that that's the place where most trust happens. So misinformation, I think, to, you know, wrap it up, is a big problem. And I think the solutions are sort of this idea of, like, real life peer-to-peer communications. And now I'm trying to remember the second part of your question.
Do you know what? I love that there. And I feel like it just reminded me of something that I'd read somewhere, where it was this idea that climate change is something that is always this foreign concept that happens further and further away in the distance until you realize that it's getting closer and closer, and until you are the one recording it, you are the one sharing this information publicly. And in a way to stop it even getting from that point is by having these dialogue of conversations, really getting yourself out there and seeing the impacts firsthand, or having these peer-to-peer conversations with those that are almost having these effects. For example, even with the fires taking place in LA, one of my friends had recently visited, and having those direct conversations where I can actually speak to a person who has directly experienced what's going on is much more impactful than being thrown a drone of media, barraged by sort of like trying to get my attention effectively. What would you want to instantly change or accelerate in terms of growth or positive impact in the surfing community or the coastal community or ocean communities? What would it be and why? And this could be policy, technology, culture.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. There in the US, there's 3 or 4 million surfers is the best guess. And, 20 to 30 million surfers worldwide. If 1 in 10 of those surfers join the Surfrider Foundation or a local conservation organization in their community, we would have incredible power, like the Trestles campaign, to influence policy and climate change laws and plastic pollution laws, both nationally and globally. If we had 300,000 people instead of 3,000 people working on these issues, it would be absolutely game-changing. So every time I look out at a crowded surf spot and there's 50 people in the water, I think if I only 5 of them would join Surfrider, we would be a force to be reckoned with. So my ask is for people to get off the sidelines and get involved in these issues, because A, they're important. B, they can make a difference. And C, they're going to have a good time doing it.
Do you know what? You're right. Feet on the ground. And that's exactly what needs to happen. We need to get more involvement. I'm part of a surfing community here in the UK. We've worked with surf specifics before. And definitely, I think it's something that with you saying that, it's something I would love to help get involved with and help you guys advocate for. We're coming really close to the end of the show today, and I just wanted to wrap things up by kind of asking, what is the most important thing you want our listeners to take away from our chat here today? We already know feet on the ground. We're going to get that done, but apart from...
Yeah, I mean, I think although these issues that we're talking about, climate change, plastic pollution, are daunting and massive, we absolutely have the solutions for all of them. We don't need to figure out what to do. We just need to do it. And so I think this is really about about creating that sort of wave of change. We're seeing it with renewable energy now, how quickly it's changed. And I say this all the time. When I was a little kid, there was one phone in the house, and it was connected to the wall with a wire. And that wire was then connected to the handle. So you had to stand in the kitchen to talk to anyone on the phone. And look at where we are today. With our energy, we're still like burning stuff like cavemen and generally. And so we need to embrace technology and make that change, but it's absolutely possible, and we can build a better plastic that doesn't pollute the planet and the ocean also. So the solutions exist is the message that I think I want people to take home, and we just need to implement them and do it quickly.
Fantastic. And where can they learn more about Surfrider, and if they want to get involved, how can they get involved?
Yeah, surfrider.org, or look up Surfrider on the various social channels. There are activities taking place all over the U.S., and we have affiliates in Europe, Morocco, Senegal, Australia, Japan, and Canada, and Argentina. So, and you've got Surfers Against Sewage right in your backyard. So, yeah, I just encourage people to check us out. Get involved if they're listening in one of those locations, or find an organization like us in your community and get active.
Thank you so much for joining us today and speaking to everyone about the amazing work your organization is doing. I found it so insightful, and I've really enjoyed our chat. And thank you everyone for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find out more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.